And good afternoon. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Condon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
And today we're going to cover this issue of the Cuban Five, who've been won their freedom and have returned to Cuba. And we need to talk about what the word normalization means and such. And we're going to be talking to two wonderful authors. We're going to go on this subject. We're going to go from Keith to Keith. We're going to speak to Keith Ellis, a professor emeritus, retired, University of Toronto, and later with Keith Bolander, who has written Voices from the Other Side, an oral history of terrorism against Cuba, which sets the framework for the work of the Cuban Five and their attempt to protect the Cuban people from terrorism. But we're joined now, I believe, by Professor Keith Ellis. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I'm here.
Keith, thank you very much. I'll bet you were surprised by this development. If you were going to give a speech about this, how would you describe what has happened in the past few days?
Well, it's a very good thing that has happened. And it is surprising. As a matter of fact, as working on a book, translating a book that was published in Cuba on the 6th of October this year, a book whose intention was to try to get the five freed, because the authors thought that people in the United States didn't know enough about the case of the five, and they wrote this book. And it's a really fine and important book with much detail. And the interesting thing about the book is that the five themselves participated in the writing. And so the book is very interesting. And in a sense, we wanted to have the book out. but the great thing that has happened is that the five are out before this book could be out.
So you're probably one who doesn't like Hollywood endings, and you end up with a Hollywood ending.
That's right. But perhaps the book is still valuable because it has much information about U.S.-Cuban relations over the years, and the experience of the five in the context of that relationship.
Tell us about what you think the word normalization, did I add a syllable? Normalization is going to mean. You must be going through the speeches and documents with a keen eye.
Well, there are some things that are effective right away. For example, the five, and that for the Cubans and the Cuban people in general is the crucial thing, the most important thing, because they wanted the five back home, because the five for the Cubans are heroes, and one can understand the deep feeling they have for the five, because the five did what they did, offered to do what they did, when Cuba was desperate to find a way to stave off the activities of terrorists based in Miami. And in the 1990s, what happened was that with the fall of the Soviet Union, the disappearance of the Soviet Union, Cuba's great trading partners, Cuba was in a very, very delicate and precarious situation because all its trade collapsed. Its GDP collapsed by about a third over a four-year period up to 1993. And the people in Miami thought that this was the time to go in for the kill. And they stepped up a bombing campaign, Cuba, a terrorist bombing campaign. And there were bombing hotels, bombing restaurants, child care places, and so on. It was all out the attack against Cuba. And so these five were went to the United States to try to monitor the activities of the terrorists from Miami. And they, in fact, thought that they were doing something that was to the benefit not only of Cuba, but of the United States as well, because in the history of terrorist activities, the United States had suffered a great deal from the terrorist activities of the Cuban Americans within the United States itself.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did Cuba suffer, but other countries suffered. And there were plans to make other countries, and attempts to make other countries suffer. Because, for example, I don't know if you remember what happened in about the year 2000 when Fidel Castro was going to a conference in Panama.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to be talking to students. Students had asked for a meeting with him. And there were about 700 students who were going to be congregating in a convocation hall at the university. And Posada Carriles, who was the head terrorist, had gone to Panama, gone with explosives and so on with a team to blow up the convocation hall with all those people.
Mm-hmm.
And when Fidel Castro arrived in Panama, he could call a press conference and announce precisely what was going to happen. And he did it so precisely that Posada Carriles was arrested, that the explosives were seized and so on. And he was tried in Panama and convicted. But the president of Panama was really more to the side of the Miami terrorists than to justice.
Yeah, isn't that the woman who retired herself to Miami?
Yes. At the end of her term in Panama, she went out. The first thing she did was to free the terrorists from prison in Panama. And then she went on to Miami and lived there ever after.
Well,
So these things, children were suffering in Cuba, and, you know, there was no care at all in what these terrorists were doing. And so the population was on edge in Cuba. And these five did a tremendous job in, without doing any harm to the United States, mm-hmm. without being armed themselves,
yes.
Just through information. Some of them went in dramatic ways. You know, one of them, for example, stole an airplane from Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Landed in Miami, so that gave him good credentials of being an anti-Castro
yeah.
person, and that made him have access to information about what the terrorists were doing. So they did this heroic work and got put into prison with sentences that were really outside of any kind of reasonable limit.
They embarrassed the superpower.
Yes,
with their exploits. Frankly, if there were true, you know, films, dramatic films made about exploits, their yes. exploits would be the ones you'd want to do.
Exactly, and so they did that, and also not only by the exploits of that sort, but by their conduct even in prison. They were men of tremendous cultural sensibilities, and they didn't do anything that you know, that there was no case against any of them for misbehavior, let us say, while they were incarcerated. But yet they were put in the hole. according to the legal system, the time limit for being in the hole in prison should be about 60 days, and they put him for a year and 7 months. They thought the penal system, after the failure of the judicial system that didn't function at all in any reasonable way. For example, the defense of the five asked that the trial be moved from Miami to Fort Lauderdale, just fairly nearby, because the atmosphere in Miami was so poisoned. You know, when the Miami Cubans do something against Cuba, And the case is to be tried in Miami. Then they start celebrating the victory because they know they're going to win. Hmm. And they have ways of intimidating juries and judges and so on.
Indeed.
And so the Fort Lauderdale move was denied by the judge. And everything was done to the limit of unreasonableness, to the detriment of the fight. And so the sentences from 17 years up to one of them getting two life sentences plus 15 years was his sentence.
Interesting math.
Yeah. And so with this kind of penalty and one worried about his... For Cubans, you see, the family relationships are so important. And this is something that comes out in this book that was just published. It is called Portrait of an Absence.
Mm-hmm.
And
we can expect to see this book, I hope.
But I think I suggested to them that they have the book, but with now an epilogue.
Sure.
By the five themselves, because, you see, they're really good writers. They're really cultivated people.
I noticed in some of the painters, they did artwork that was...
Yeah, they do artwork. Two of them are painters, two of them are poets, and they write very well, and they show a concern about other people and about saving lives. That was the main thing. They're there, they went to the United States to save lives, and that's what they carried out.
Well, indeed, and successfully. But it was a great psychological shock. The Americans ended up having to talk about all these crimes, whether they wanted to or not.
Yeah.
Because, who are these men, and what was their mission? And then, are there men in Miami who committed horrendous crimes? Turns out, yes.
Yeah.
By the way, you must have noticed that Mr. Carrilli showed up Saturday on the streets in Miami.
That's right.
And spoke.
Yeah.
And no one put a handcuff on him, and nobody said he was a bad person. And he blew up an airliner with 73 children on it.
Yeah. Well, that's how it's been there. And sometimes they go to extremes with when Posada Carriles is going to be transported in airplanes on. They give him protection for his ears so the noise doesn't hurt his hearing. Yeah. All kinds of...
Well, so he can't hear the devil inviting him?
All kinds of fine considerations. Yes. But one of the interesting things that... one of the benefits I think the United States can get from this detente with Cuba is I know that President Obama is concerned about the history of torture within the CIA and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It should have the CIA talk to the Cubans about how they get information from people without torturing them. Because it's really spectacular, the way in which, for example, the Miami people would sometimes employ poor people from countries like, say, El Salvador, to take bombs to Cuba and set off bombs in places like hotels and so on. And these people would be caught sometimes. And they'd be caught, and they'd be arrested, and they'd be tried. And they would be people who would actually express shame for what they did and talk about what they did in the context of the shame they felt. Because the Cubans would attend not only to them if they're not well and so on, but sometimes to their children. One of them, in one case, and it's in the book, was suffering from dengue, hemorrhagic dengue. And his daughter, who suffered from hemorrhagic dengue, was healed by the Cuban doctors. And so he is really ashamed of what he had done and talked about this. It's very interesting, the way in which Cuba operates in these ways.
Mm-hmm.
When they talk about their healthcare system and helping people, they make no exceptions. no exceptions to that. They do it in Cuba, they do it abroad, and it doesn't matter the history of the person who comes up for treatment, they do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would be interesting if the United States would open a dialogue and learn. But now that we have, like, for example, Ebola is an international issue at the forefront of fighting, that are the Cuban doctors.
Right.
It's just, you know.
Exactly. I mean, they see the need to save lives, and they see the danger that if something isn't done with healthcare workers attending to these people who are ill and stricken with Ebola, and if a study isn't made of the best ways of controlling the disease, if the epidemiologists just do not get into the picture and study these things, then there could be an explosion of Ebola in the world. And so the Cubans offered to be hands-on people attending to patients.
Yeah, they provided doctors, medicine, and Americans so far have provided more military than they have doctors.
The Americans have explained that they are providing infrastructure, providing hospitals, quickly built encampments, and so on, to house people who are suffering from these things. But the Cubans are doing the treatment, along with some other people from other countries, the Doctors Without Borders and so on, are doing good work helping people. But the Cubans are in the forefront of that, with about 400 people so far, medical personnel, attending to people with Ebola.
We're speaking to Professor Keith Ellis, Professor Emeritus, University of Toronto, retired, and of course, he is the author of several books and articles on Nicholas Guillen and other Hispanic writers. He's been honored with the distinction for National Culture of Cuba, and as a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. Keith, I wonder, how much do you attribute this development to the isolation of the United States in South America in its attempt to isolate Cuba?
Right. Well, yes, there's a reaction to that. The thing is that what has been happening in Latin America and the Caribbean in the last decade is that there's a sense of unity that has developed. It was promoted in great measure, well, initially by Fidel Castro, but in great measure subsequently by Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And they formed these groups, these associations, like the ALBA group, but the most interesting group as far as the effect on Cuba and the rest of Latin America and the United States is concerned, is the CELAC group, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. Mm-hmm. The CELAC group, they organized, for example, they said, first of all, that it is time for Cuba to be fully involved along with the other Caribbean and Latin American countries. And they insisted, for example, CELAC really came to replace the Organization of American States in the imagination and the minds of people in Latin America and the Caribbean. Because it treated the countries more justly, more equally. And when CELAC was formed, CELAC kept out of the picture both the United States and Canada.
Because
it wasn't felt that these countries shared the point of view and the interests of the developing countries in a full way. But I must say that this measure that Obama has now agreed to, And with the involvement of Canada, mm-hmm. Canada, I think, will earn some very good favorable marks from the Caribbean and Latin America for its participation in this effort.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an encouraging thing that there could be a new way of dealing with the Latin American and Caribbean countries
mm-hmm.
as a result of this. Because there is going to be a summit in April of the old Organization of American States. That is the one where the United States is the predominant country. And the countries of CELAC all insisted that Cuba should be included in that. And the United States didn't want to see Cuba included. But it is one of the things that has really forced Obama's hand to mm-hmm. to make this agreement now, to get Cuba recognized by the Organization of American States as a full-fledged member of that mm-hmm. organization. And mm-hmm. so the timing of it had to do with what is going to happen, and because it's a matter of high tension between the United States and
yes.
and CELAC.
I had heard that Panama intended to invite Cuba anyway.
Yeah.
That was starting to become a really embarrassing problem. That's the host
right,
country yeah. says, I'm going to invite Cuba.
That's right. It would have been, and the countries, it is surprising that countries like even Colombia, that is really intent on being an ally of the United States. On this Cuba issue, they wanted Cuba included as well.
Mm-hmm.
So Obama is in a difficult position there, and the CELAC countries in general might have had a strong role, well, certainly had a strong role in this détente that's now being announced by the United States and Cuba.
I'm very glad to hear that. That's very interesting thesis. I guess finally here, this development with the recognition and the attendance in April at the OA at the Organization of American States. It looks to me it's like a vindication and ratification of the reality that the people of South America always had, which is they always were with Fidel.
Exactly.
Isn't this really just, you know, the recognition? All those governments, even when they were voting against Cuba, understood that their people revered him.
That's right. That's right. That's interesting. I mentioned Canada earlier. You know that when Cuba was expelled from the Organization of American States and the United States requested that countries break relations with Cuba, there are two countries that didn't, and the two countries were Mexico and Canada. And it's good to see Canada doing something now that reflects some of that thinking, some of that role that Canada played at that time with Diefenbaker.
Yes. But it's Diefenbaker, and then we had this, Canadians all remember the curious moment at the funeral of Pierre Trudeau, and they looked, and sitting amongst the dignitaries was one Fidel Castro.
Exactly.
It made everyone scratch their heads and think, how do governments work these things out? But Keith, it's great talking to you. I bet you're very pleased, and we look forward to this book.
The Cubans are tremendous. I should tell you
mm-hmm.
that this settlement, or so far, was announced on the 16th of December. The 16th of December is the day of San Lázaro. You know that Cuba has an official religion, which is Catholicism, but the real religion in Cuba is Santeria.
Uh-huh.
And San Lázaro is the, what am I calling, the high priest or saint of Santeria. And it's a day of tremendous festivity, of drumming all over Cuba. And so the coincidence of the announcement with this day of celebration of San Lázaro is something that at the other level, of spiritual level, reflects deeply this Cuban spirit.
Wow.
And so the enjoyment and the happiness is deep and widespread.
Yeah, the day of the drum.
Yeah, the drum.
Oh, I like that. Well, Keith, I know that you are a poet, and that one doesn't like to disturb an artist, but it would really be nice if you wrote a poem about this.
I'll bet
there are going to be some, don't you think?
Oh, yes. Well, there are so many poems dedicated to the five. So many. I mean, and we all wrote something about the five, and it's good to see.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to seeing your book.
Okay.
And we thank you very much. You told us many, many good stories. Thank you.
Good. Okay, not at all.
Keith Ellis, thank you.
Thank you for asking me. Bye.
Bye-bye. Keith Ellis, Professor Emeritus, University of Toronto. He also is an honorary doctor at University of Havana for his work. Someday, by the way, we're going to have him just to review, because Keith is a poet. He's also a translator of poets, and he is involved in some of the more important literary theories about the development of writing in Caribbean and South America. This is also the day, this is December 22nd, that William Tecumseh Sherman sent a message to President Lincoln, and he said, I want to offer you for Christmas the city of Savannah. And where the Confederates, the slave owners, were having their backs broken. And this was another one of those things to mark. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, by the way. And we're on the web, taylor-report.com, where you'll be able to hear this broadcast if you want to find it in the future. And we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be back to talk to the other Keith Bolander.